webcasting to the world, live, the good news of God's righteousness for all humanity. This is the Gospel Revolution Radio Network. Greetings, beautiful humans. This is Greg Amberge, coming to you from beautiful Kings Mills, Ohio, and you're listening to the Glenn Klein Online broadcast that emanates from the studio in Tampa, Florida. Sean O'Halloran is at the controls, and he's waiting for your call tonight if you are listening live and want to call in. It is Hump Day, January 13th, the only January 13th, 2010 in the history of humanity. And now we'd like to welcome in from Houston, Texas, the president of the Gospel Revolution, Michael Williams. Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Greg. It's good to have you with me tonight in the absence of our most noble broadcaster himself, Glenn Klein. He's in California and had to attend his one of his aunts, a memorial service. For her.
Right.
She was 90 years old. And so he and Dawn flew out several days ago. The memorial service was today, and they're en route back home as we speak right now. Should be arriving sometime this evening in into Tampa. So
yeah, I spoke to Glenn today.
Yeah.
And he said all went well. Before we go any further, let me give out the phone number. If you're listening live and you'd like to call us with a question or a comment, the number is 800-436-3260. That's a toll-free call. I think it even works in the Great White North, doesn't it, Mike?
It does.
800-436-3260. So give us a call, and we'll put you on the air with us. Mike, in the news today... of course, the big news, President Obama had a press conference to talk about the just unbelievable devastation in Haiti.
Yeah.
And it's just such a sad situation. I think they're saying that the death count is probably around 100,000 and could go even higher. And a lot of that has just to do with the substandard housing and all that. And it was a massive earthquake, a 7.
Yeah.
Would do significant damage in Southern California, where they build all the buildings to very specific earthquake codes. But in an impoverished country like Haiti, there is nothing, anything near that. And there are so many people trapped inside buildings, and it's just a terrible situation.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it really is. You know, they of course the reporters are just now, just today, have been arriving, and they're talking of you know, bodies stacked up and bodies lining the streets, you know, under sheets to give them the greatest point of respect as possible, which is only to lay them in the streets. And with temperatures 90 degrees today and again tomorrow, you know, it's the tragedy that exists now is only going to grow in that type of a situation with disease and you know, with the lack of water and food and medicine. And it really is a great tragedy,
One of the problems they're having is that the main airport runway, is they're not sure it's usable, and so instead they can't just fly humanitarian aid in. They have to bring it in by helicopter or boat.
Yeah,
it's really slowing down the process.
That's true.
And of course, whenever a tragedy strikes, we always have certain people on the evangelical side that weigh in with the reason it happened. And I think you were aware of what our good friend Pat Robertson said today. Why don't you fill us in about that?
Yeah, just hideous, you know, as always, as we can count on from Pat Pat Robertson, you know, when Ariel Sharon had a stroke, he proclaimed that it was God's judgment on him for negotiating with the Palestinians over the occupied territories. And he's always got something really nutso to say about this stuff because he totally does not know the gospel of peace at all. It is beginning even more so to absolutely shock me that people call themselves ministers and they don't even know the most basic principle of the gospel, which is the gospel of peace. And here again, of course, is his rambling ignorance. I just have to call it what it is, where he announced today on the 700 Club that the reason everything is so bad in Haiti and there's so many tragedies there is because in 1844, the leadership of Haiti made a pact with the devil that if he would free them from French rule, that they would serve him. And so, of course, Robertson's declaration as to why this earthquake took place is because of what a handful of people did or didn't do. He, of course, says it's absolute fact. And, of course, it was 1844. It's probably more folklore than it is anything. But gave him the perfect opportunity to promote his Antichrist doctrine and say that this was a curse that was upon these people, and of course they need to turn to Jesus. Kind of like one of the reporters from Fox News offered the remedy for Tiger Woods last week, saying that he needed to switch from Buddhism to Christianity so he could get a good dose of really easy redemption. As opposed to Buddhism, where you had to kind of work for it a little bit. I think the redemption that Tiger needs is kind he needs to work for a little bit rather than the kind that comes so easy. The kind that comes so easy has already come for him. So we've got this, you know, we've got Pat out on the forefront again uttering this nonsense. You know, I would say that it was just due to old age, but you know, I'm getting old and I'm not that stupid. And I'm sorry,
on my
but
blog,
that's just stupid.
I wrote a while back an article about the Ten Commandments, about leaving behind the Ten Commandments, and one of the principles that I wrote about was that in the United States, we never hold children accountable for their parents' misdeeds.
Yes.
And that's just a principle of American justice because it just seems, if someone is, we don't send their kids to debtor's prison because somebody died in debt.
Right.
And we don't send their kids to prison if somebody commits a murder. And Pat Robertson's saying that his God holds accountable, people for the actions of others several generations before that they had nothing to do with, and they
well,
did
fact,
nothing
they,
on its face. It's just unjust.
Absolutely, and they quote from the Old Testament, which they do not. They quote from the law, but they forget to quote from the prophets. The law does say that the sins of the father will be visited up to the 10th generation. Now, I'd have to count how many generations it's been since 1844, but, it's been a few. But the fact of it is that they forgot to read what the prophets said, which also affirmed that that was true, but said, but there's a Redeemer that will come. And that Redeemer came, and the entire human race was released from any curse of sin whatsoever. You can't be under a curse of sin when sin itself no longer exists between God and man.
Well, now that's interesting. Before we go any further, I want to give out the number again. If you want to call us, if you're listening live tonight, the number is 800-436-3260. My mother said something to me recently that really got me thinking. I was thinking about it today. My mother's a Pentecostal. She's a minister, and she's getting up in years, but she's still a minister in a large Pentecostal church in the Cincinnati area. And she said to me that she's so tired of going to these conferences, like
Paula White,
the blonde chick that used to be in Florida with her
Paula
husband
White.
Paula White, yes. Paula White and a lot of these other women that have these conferences, and they get together, and then you'll have the prophetic group like Dutch Sheets and guys like that. They all have one single thing that seems to be in common. They're always talking about what God is about to do.
Yep.
God is about to do this. And I remember we used to hear that at Kenneth Copeland meetings and Kenneth Hagin meetings when I was a young man. This is what God is about to do. God's about to sweep the earth with his glory. God's about to bring us a revival. God's about to bring a big healing move across the country. God's about to do this and God's about to do that. You remember that? That's
a theme that goes
all the way from Oral Roberts, maybe even before, on through, and it's especially prevalent in every sort of charismatic or prophetic type ministry today. God is about to do this. When the big thing was going on in Lakeland last year, Todd Bentley was always talking about God's about to do this. Well, that's the problem with evangelicalism and Pentecostalism and the charismatic movement and all that and the prophetic. They totally are forgetting that God has already done what God's going to do. And in sending his son. And they see everything as a future event, and we get to the future and nothing happens. We're still looking to the future, and we're still looking on out ahead to see what God's going to do. And it seems like God never does it.
Yeah, you know, according to evangelical Christianity, Jesus is just a token boy, you know.
Exactly.
He really did not accomplish anything at all. You know, he just came to let us know what might happen sometime in the future. And the fact of it is, though, that all of the prophets disagree with these people. The prophets are very firm in their convictions about the life, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, that was the fulfillment of the 70th week of Daniel. The resurrection of Jesus was the fulfillment of the 70th week of Daniel, and that fulfillment was the redemption of the entire planet, the redemption of the world. There is no prophet who would agree with any of these folks. In fact, they thrive by taking prophecies out of context as though it is unfulfilled, because they absolutely do not believe that the kingdom of God is already here and that it is already in the hearts, that it's already with us, that it is here. They so don't believe that, and they're still waiting for the manifestation of a physical kingdom, which Jesus said will never come, and said that the
exactly.
kingdom of God would never be seen with the physical eye, and they're still looking for it. And they're still looking
yes.
for physical evidence of it. Glenn repeats,
I had a rich tradition in that sort of teaching. Finest Dake stayed in our house, the guy that wrote the Dake Bible.
Oh, is that right?
When I was a little boy. And he,
did you
he
keep those sheets?
I found that guy fascinating. I was probably 10 or 12 years old when he came, and I remember just sitting and driving him crazy, asking him questions.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated, even at that age, with the whole Bible prophecy thing.
Absolutely.
And when I got to be in my late teens and early 20s, I was getting very frustrated with a lot of my Pentecostal teachings, and I thought, well, you know, what I'm going to specialize in is this prophecy stuff. I'm going to learn this end time stuff and be an expert on that.
Yep.
So I really dove into it for a year or so, and I had a tremendous problem trying to get somebody to explain to me Daniel.
Yep.
I read what everybody said about it. This splitting up of the weeks thing for an indefinite period of time when everything else was exactly tied to history, and it was
absolutely,
it was very specific about, you know, this is going to happen. And then all of a sudden we get to this nebulous period where we go, what, 2,000 years, maybe more, and we were supposed to have some more weeks here at the end, and, you know, the 70th week, and I couldn't get anybody to explain to me how that is real. And one of the first things, when I first heard you talking about all prophecy being fulfilled, you weren't even talking about Daniel and,
right,
you know, and Revelation and all that stuff. But immediately that clicked in my mind, and I thought, wait a minute, if all prophecy is fulfilled, then that would mean that Daniel's 70th week culminated at the cross.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, it all just kind of, it just kind of fit together, and it was like a big bomb going off in my head, just because of the training I'd had as a child.
Yeah, and you know, it's been so amazing for me, and a wonderful experience, an amazing experience to watch just one fragment of truth to penetrate. That's the reason I love reaching people who know everything. That they've
exactly
been trained well in their end-time doctrine. They've been trained well in their salvation doctrine. They've been trained well in their redemption doctrine. Because if they've been trained well, all you got to do is pull one straw out, and the whole house of cards comes tumbling down. And
yeah,
just like with you. You see, the people that I have had the greatest success with is those who know the most. It's not the inexperienced.
Right.
The inexperienced think, well, I don't know one way or the other. But when the gospel truth matches up against the false doctrine of evangelical Christianity, just one thread of truth breaks through it all, just like what happened with you with that one comment about the fulfillment of the scriptures. Then there's just this whole range of things that begins to fall in place that I don't have to teach you. I don't have to sit down and show you how this and how that and why this and why that. Because one element of the truth of the gospel is it affects with such magnitude, especially in the lives of those who have trained themselves in this false doctrine. The more Bible schools you've been to, the better off, the better chances I have. The more biblical training you have, the better chance I have to reach a person with the gospel.
I totally agree with that. And let me remind the beautiful humans that are listening here tonight, if you missed last week's webcast, I've listened to it 2.5 times now. It's just one of the best webcasts that's ever been done. I wasn't a part of it. Glenn was leading it, but the conclusions that were made, I think you've pretty much said those things before, but the way that it came out was just phenomenal. And so I would encourage everybody, if you know, to go back and listen to the, what would that be, January the, about the 6th or something?
Last Wednesday.
Yes.
I don't know exactly when
January
6th. Last Wednesday.
I'm looking at my calendar. So when we're talking, go ahead and talk a little bit more about this thing in Haiti. I have some friends that have an orphanage down there.
And yeah, tell us about
12,
that.
Yeah, there were 12 people from their church who were on the island when the earthquake hit. And, you know, anybody that runs an orphanage or any kind of a program in Haiti, whether it's Christian-based or whether it's government-based or it's just secular humanitarianism, there's every single agency down there is overwhelmed. This is before the earthquake.
Oh,
there's
absolutely.
Such incredible poverty. Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere.
That's true.
And there are millions of people living on a tiny island, and they have cut down trees to the point that all their topsoil has eroded out into the ocean. They can't grow anything. They can't be self-sufficient. And there's a tremendous amount of voodoo and things like that on the island, and just a total lack of any kind of education. There's not a lot of law and order. There's a history throughout the years of just brutal, dictators and bad government. And there's so many reasons for the poverty in Haiti. And then you throw this massive earthquake on top of
yeah.
it. And there's this sea of just poor, just very unfortunate people. Who were just their daily life was survival before this thing hit.
Yes.
Now, it's just unthinkable what's going on there. And so if you had an orphanage in Haiti before the earthquake hit, you felt overwhelmed. You had to turn away kids that you wish you could take.
Yeah.
And one of my friends is a Pentecostal preacher who went down to Guatemala on a mission trip and came back with a child. Well, he had to make two more trips down there in order to adopt him, but you see this and there's such a desire to help and you're so overwhelmed with the need and so I would encourage anybody if you know of an organization or somebody, even the government has a way to help through whitehouse.gov. I heard President Obama say today, if you can do anything to help the people of Haiti, even if it's sending food or clothes or anything, I would encourage you to do it.
Yeah,
but
sure.
This is not God's judgment on Haiti any more than a hurricane or an earthquake or a tornado that hits the United States is God's judgment on us. God's judgment was poured out. And, it upsets me to hear somebody as prominent as Pat Robertson always talking about the judgment of God in arrears after the fact, when the real prophets of God proclaimed the judgment of God before it happened, not
yeah.
after it happened.
Yeah, and the thing that gives us the ability to be open-handed and helpful in these things is to not ascribe the punishment or judgment of God, because there are a lot of people who believe that this was the judgment of God who will stand back and say, well, they got what they deserved. And of course, the odd thing is, of course, the 700 Club will send their relief programs over there. But all of these guys, which were grateful for anything anybody does, but the thing that I know about all of these religious-based relief organizations is that their major goal is not to help the people; it's to convert the people. They believe a disaster is their opportunity to go and prove to people. I heard one of them say, pertaining to another disaster. I happened across a Christian radio program, and there was a particular disaster that had just taken place in India, which I think was an earthquake at the time. And they said, this is our opportunity to go over there and let them see that their God can't help them, that our God can. And I just thought, you know, my God, what a horrid motivation for going in to help somebody is to promote your doctrine and your religion, regardless of whose it is. I mean, I would not want to take advantage of that type of situation in the life of a Catholic, in the life of a Jack and Roxella. You know, I'd want to help and not take advantage of the moment. But that's the basic understanding of evangelical Christianity is not just you go help, you take advantage of the situation to promote your religion. And one of them that I saw on earlier too was Billy Graham's son. What is his first name? It just escaped me.
Franklin.
Franklin was on, and of course, all of the news agencies have their own particular religious proclivities, and they'll have these guys on. And I thought, you know, what do you have him on for at all? I mean, are you wanting him to declare how many of these people in Haiti went to hell like he did at 9/11? Is that what we're waiting on him to eloquently tell us about? Because when 9/11 happened, he came on CNN and declared that 80% of the people who died in that tower, in the Twin Towers, 80% of them went to hell, that only 20% of them went to heaven. And I wonder what he would say about Haiti. I mean, even though his organization has, quote, been there to, quote, convert the heathen all of this time, without a tremendous amount of success, it doesn't look like. But, you know, is that what we're looking to him for now? I mean, you know, and again, I'm very grateful for any of the humanitarian aid that they give. I just wish they didn't have to take advantage of the people at the moment to try to convert them from one empty religion that believes that they have to do something to avoid punishment from God to another religion that believes they have to do something to avoid punishment from God.
Yeah, and I would also be very careful about who you give money to. There was just there's a lawsuit, one of the big humanitarian agencies, I don't want to name the name. I think I know which one it is, but I can't remember exactly. No, it was Save the Children. That they're in the midst of lawsuits because there was some embezzling going on and things like that.
Yeah.
There are enough people doing work in Haiti that if you ask around, you can find somebody that's reputable to give your money.
Yeah,
to
even just the Red Cross. I mean, my gosh, you know, the Red Cross, the Red Cross.
Yes.
And both of these organizations are well known for getting help and aid to people, you know, without a religious slant to them.
Right.
So, do be careful. I do encourage everyone to, as others have, to be able to, you know, to do something. You know, if you're going to do something financially, make sure you do it through something that is not particularly, doesn't have to have a religious slant. These people don't need a new religion right now. They need help. And,
Food,
you know,
and
the UN
water.
Is there. There's donations that can be made through those organizations. Former President Clinton was on also, letting people know that his organization was there to help, which is, you know, an organization that's highly scrutinized as to what they do with their funds. So, if you're going to help, and we do encourage everyone to help these folks out as much as possible, don't do it through some group that has their main main motivation as to trying to reach them to convert them.
Yeah, I would agree. Mike, there's an interesting case that went to trial today, or yesterday, in the Cincinnati area. There's a guy who is he's a over-the-road truck driver Monday through Friday, and then on Sundays he pastors a church in Cincinnati. And a few months ago, he was driving just completely drunk and just drove over top of a local prosecuting attorney and killed him. And he went to trial today on murder charges. Well, when his family and his church members first heard the story, they thought he was being framed by the prosecutor's office because they swore this guy did not drink. He was a teetotaler. And when the truth came out, this guy was he had a terrible alcohol problem. And the only time he drank is when he was away from home driving his 18-wheeler over the road.
God.
And that night that he killed this prosecutor, he had bought a case of beer, which was 24 cans of beer, and had consumed 18 of them in a four-hour period. And when I first heard that, I thought that story is just a microcosm of what a lot of us went through as Christians in covering up our, I don't know what you would want to call it. You can call it sin. You can call it, you know, our shortcomings.
Covering up our self-righteousness.
Yeah, exactly. And and this guy, it's such a sad story because he was so overcome with the desire to drink alcohol that the only time he would do it is when he was driving his 18-wheeler.
Well, it is
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's the classic secret life of a legalist. I say this unequivocally. To what degree? It may not be to this degree, and it certainly may not be this particular issue. But every legalist has a secret life.
Yeah. I had one when I was a legalist.
Every legalist. You had one, I had one. Every legalist has a secret life. And, man, I tell you what, I just wish that these guys could understand that we dwell in the secret place, under the shadow of the Almighty, that we dwell in a righteousness that doesn't require that we hide anything else, because we are completely under the shadow of the Almighty. We dwell in the secret place of the Almighty. And you don't have to have a secret life. But whenever, Greg, whenever we have self-righteousness, to every degree there's self-righteousness, there's secrets.
Yes, exactly.
To every degree that there is self-righteousness, there are secrets. You may not know what area it's in, but I'll guarantee you there are secrets to every degree of self-righteousness that a human being has. A lot of people wonder why the gospel is so resisted amongst the hierarchy of the religious. In Christianity, especially, which is who we try to reach out to the most, because that's where that the gospel, I think, can bring the most relief, is to Christians, which sounds really odd. The gospel needs to get to Christians. But I really do believe that. But in that realm, the reason that they get so frightened by the prospect of the truth of the gospel is because of their secret lives. regardless of what it is. And some of them are so convinced that their secret lives will never be revealed that they absolutely, just like this guy being, quote, a teetotaler, probably his greatest sermons were against alcohol.
Yeah, exactly.
And being of the Pentecostal persuasion, I think you said, he would be, of course,
yeah,
preaching against alcohol. But that is what self-righteousness does. Instead of giving people the and of course that's all built because the very first thing that we do is offer people salvation. Now we teach people that redemption and salvation, of course, that's all one thing to the Christian world. But we teach people that redemption and salvation is, I used to drink, now I don't. I used to cuss, now I don't. I used to lie, now I don't. I used to cheat, now I don't. I used to like sex, now I don't. And when we set people up for that, we have set them up to become the greatest fakes and phonies and liars that the planet has ever seen.
Right.
Because redemption and salvation is not change from any of those things. All of those things are irrelevant to redemption and to salvation.
I love the saying that you and Glenn say a lot, this particular transgression is not a gospel issue.
Yeah,
I love that. I've incorporated that into my own vocabulary. You know, this affair that this politician had is not a gospel issue.
Absolutely.
This is worthy of repeating many, many times in many, many situations.
Because to get the gospel to people, we have to define more of what the gospel, at least just as much what the gospel is not, as we have to declare what it is. Because in evangelical Christianity, all of those things are gospel issues because it has nothing to do with anything but self-righteousness. And where the gospel is concerned, the gospel is two things, the gospel of grace and the gospel of peace. And the gospel of grace and the gospel of peace says these things are now irrelevant. They're not irrelevant to the person's personal life and relationships.
Exactly.
But they are totally irrelevant in relationship to God because the blood of Christ has erased and eradicated all of those things as issues in a relationship with God. Now, the law made them issues. Now, let me repeat that again. The law made them issues. But they were made issues by the law, because it's just being human. And the law literally outlawed everything that was a basic, common human passion to the extreme and to the most finite. So it covers, the law covers all of those things. Now, we're good at emphasizing the big things, but we're not very good at emphasizing the finite things that the law condemns just as equally as murder. But all of those things were condemned to give us a glimpse of the reality. This can't be the real problem. If this is the problem, then we are all screwed forever.
Yes.
If this is the problem, then we have no redemption. But that's what the law was given. And that's why I respect and love the law so much, because the law helps us to understand what the problem is not. Whereas in evangelical Christianity, because they don't accept the totality of the law, I do. I accept the totality of the law. I accept that the law condemns the person who even thinks about it as bad as the person who did it. I accept that the law condemns the person who even got angry and condemns them equally with a person who has murdered 10,000 people. I accept it. Evangelical Christianity does not. That's why they get screwed up about the comparisons that bring the wonderful revelation of the gospel into clear focus, because the law does not have its full work in these people's lives because their religious leaders have watered the law down. It is so amazing that people who tout the law are the very ones who stand guilty of reducing the law to being completely ineffective in doing what it was given to do.
Yeah, I would encourage anybody that's listening. I found this out on the web. It's a Jewish website. The address is JEWFAQ, like Jew Frequently Asked Questions.org. They have listed the 613 commandments in the Torah. And I would have to say that 99% of Christians have no idea about all the commandments listed in the Torah that were part of the law that were commanded to keep, in, not just the Ten Commandments, but all of these. You should read them. I would go to JEWFAQ.org and look up those commandments. Some are so ridiculous. Some of them make pretty good sense. Some of them are so ridiculous that you just think, why in the world would somebody make a law about that? But it was God giving us a shot to understand that we can't please him in the flesh.
And then to apply Jesus' full definition of the law, that each one of those, it's not just because you do it, it's because you think it. So when you read those 600 and some odd laws, when you read them, remember it's not just forbidden that you do it, it's forbidden that you even think about doing it.
I love the one that you are not to wear garments made of wool and linen mixed together.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I've thought about that. So I guess I'm guilty too. Mike, we've got a call. We're going to welcome Jennifer Bradham from Columbia, South Carolina. She's got a question for Mike. Jennifer, welcome to the Glenn Klein online broadcast. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. How about you?
We're doing great. You had a question for Mike?
Hey, Jennifer.
Well, I had a couple of questions. I wonder what you're talking about, prophecy being fulfilled. I've listened to a couple of your tapes on that, but there's this one passage. I don't think it was quoted from Isaiah and Philippians about every knee bowing in the name of Jesus. And so I was kind of wondering, how exactly has that been fulfilled? Because when I was brought up during my evangelical days, you're saying that people would be forced to bow to Jesus at the end of times. And
okay, very good question. First off, that is not a prophecy of the scriptures. That is something that is, it's kind of like, you know how Jesus foretold the total collapse of Israel and the destruction of the temple. But even Jesus talking about and accurately foretelling the total collapse of the temple was not a fulfillment of the prophecy of the scriptures. Because the scriptures...
Yeah, that's from Philippians 2:10, Mike.
Yes, yeah, that is correct. This was a statement that was made by Paul in his persuasion about the full conclusion of the gospel. And I agree that will happen, but you know how it was explained to me, at least, was that every knee will bow and every tongue will confess. You know, whenever, and it'll be either done willingly or by force at the end of the world. Well, that's a long leap, but I think that foretelling that was made by Paul, which again is not a prophecy of the scriptures, that was what Paul's persuasion was, which I agree with him. Every person that leaves this life they step into the presence of the Lord, and their knee bows and their tongue confesses that Jesus Christ is Lord. Because when they leave this life, whether they're Muslim or Jew or they died in a bank robbery, their next introduction into the next life is in the presence of God. And they will know that the reason they are in the presence of God, a God with no wrath, no anger toward them, that reason is because of Jesus Christ. And this question is particularly of importance, and I really appreciate you asking it, because this is one of those places where that we get the opportunity to realign our understanding as to what prophecy of the Scripture is. When I say that all prophecy has been fulfilled, I'm talking about all prophecy of the Scriptures. And all of that was fulfilled through the life, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. But the prophecies of the Scripture is strictly the prophecies of the prophets that were prophesied under the law while the law was still in effect. At the cross, the law came to an end. Not only did the law come to an end, as Jesus said, if any point of the law has changed, he said that you will know this for sure. If any point of the law, in fact, he used the term is used, one jot or tittle of the law, has been changed at all, he said that will signify that all has been fulfilled. So through that wonderful observation that Jesus had about the joined at the hip, if you will, of the law, God's law, and all of the prophets. Remember, no prophecy was given until after the law came. And so all prophecy was given under the inspiration of the law. So the law, of course, gave the prophet the absolute imperative to prophesy, first off, what the law required and what the law would do in these aspects. And the law called for judgment. The law called for the destruction of people, nations, individuals, that their sins would be visited upon them to the 10th generation. But the same prophets also were to foretell of the Christ coming, the fulfillment of the redemption of the world. And the very same ones that foretold of what the consequences of breaking God's law was, foretold of the time when the law would be done away with and a Redeemer would come to this earth, wipe out the law, redeem the whole human race. And all of those scriptures, all of that was about all of the scriptures that were part of prophecy, all of that was fulfilled through the life, death, burial, and resurrection. Now, this statement that was made by Paul is not a prophecy of the Scriptures. It was something that Paul was convinced this is the way it's going to be. But it happening does not have anything to do with the fulfillment of Scripture. Scripture was fulfilled 2,000 years ago. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I don't know where I heard it somewhere that he was quoting something from Isaiah, but it never made sense to me, because I was taught to my growing up that people would be forced to bow to Jesus, and it never made sense. How could I glorify the Father to have people forcibly bow to him?
Yeah.
And
exactly. Keep going.
Because people talk about like God would never violate free will, but then he's gonna force people to bow to him. That never.
Yeah, I was about to read that. I was about to read the verse here. It says, "Wherefore God also hath highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name." Hey, this is old Word of Faith stuff here, Mike. I bet you can quote these.
Oh, absolutely.
"That at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, of things in heaven and things in earth and things under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." The reason that this occurrence gives God glory is because I think there's going to be a lot of people who get into heaven and say, oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Look what the way God sent his son to be our Redeemer.
Yes.
And God gets all the glory from this confession. It's not a forced confession. It's not a na-na-na-na-na, I told you I was Lord. You know, it's God getting glory. It's humanity, you know, bowing our knee and saying, what a Redeemer God gave us.
And remember also, one of the definitions, according to Thayer's, of the term glory means the view and the opinion of God. So if it's to the glory of God, it's to the view and opinion of God. That simply means that all human beings, are eventually going to come to the reality that God's view and opinion is the only view and opinion that counts, and even those who thought they were going to, quote, split hell wide open are going to split heaven wide open, and they will realize God's view and opinion is that all were redeemed through the work of Christ, and even they who denied it, railed against it, believed something else, believed nothing at all, are equally standing in the presence of God. And I tell you what, I think a lot of those folks are going to bow quicker than I do because I fully expect to be there. I fully believe. I've already bowed. I will gladly bow again. But some of these folks are going to be bowing for the first time. All of us filled with the ecstatic joy of knowing that God is a loving God who redeemed the whole entire planet, who through that Christ that he sent broke down the middle wall of partition between Jew and Gentile and between all the human race and God, and created in one man the entire human race, became one man, that in one man that God would redeem everyone in the body of one man. And that is what is going to bring this out, is that we're going to finally agree. I'm going to agree with God's view and opinion here, or I'm going to agree with his view and opinion there. It's not that I'm forced to. It's the reality that I finally know God's view and opinion. I would love for everybody to know God's view and opinion of them and the entire world while they're here. But the fact of it is, if they don't get it here, they're going to get it there.
I agree. Jennifer, could we ask you, how you heard about the Gospel Revolution and maybe Mike Williams Ministries?
It's kind of a long story, I guess, because probably it's about maybe 3 years ago I accidentally stumbled across it. I was like a senior in high school, and at first I had sort of gotten into, you heard about ultimate reconciliation and all that, but mm-hmm. I thought the idea that God had just done away with all judgment, I still thought that was really crazy. At the time, I guess I just wasn't ready to accept that. But then a year later, I started college. Oh, sorry. And I don't know how it was. I'd just gone through a really, really bad breakup, and I stumbled across the Bold Grace blog, and I ended up finding the Gospel Revolution again, and I don't know what happened this time, but it just all seemed to make sense. I don't know. I can't explain it, but it just suddenly it all clicked in, and
that's awesome.
It just made sense.
Yeah, that's great. And what's your religious background?
Southern Baptist. I've grown up in South Carolina my whole life. I live about an hour and a half from here. I'm in Columbia attending nursing school right now.
Oh, that's amazing.
Well, that's the official church of South Carolina, I think, isn't it?
I think it's not the official church of the Southeast, I think.
Yeah, I was raised Southern Baptist also. Now, you said you had a couple of questions. Is there another one?
Well, yeah, I know this one's off topic a little bit, but just growing up, and I have some people a couple years older than me have gotten married and all that, we've been told that when we get married, the idea that a husband's supposed to love us like Christ loved the church and talk about submitting to a man and all that, but and study more about what Christ did and all that. There may be very great men out there, but it doesn't seem there's one that could actually love the way Christ actually loved us.
Yeah, I've not seen it.
Yeah, I mean, they're quoting Paul in Ephesians, and
yes,
I'd like to hear your opinion on that.
Yes. Again, this was one of the things that Paul had to say, and I think one of the things that it does, I think that there's a couple of perceptions here. Is, you know, you can kind of use the woman to submit to the husband and the husband to love the wife. To me, if you take it to heart, you kind of cancel both of them out. Because the woman is never going to totally submit to her husband.
The husband
is never going to love his wife the way Christ loves the church. So to me, it's like a mutual cancellation of each other that, you know, forget these ultimatums, because no one can achieve them. And just go for the happiest life you can get, you know? Find a good guy that you're comfortable with and that loves you, and a guy, you know, if marriage is something that that a couple wants, just make sure that you're looking at it from the point of reality. You know, there's not a woman I know of that'll even allow that to be said in her wedding ceremony anymore.
I try to bring that to my wife every now and then, and she just shuts me down.
Greg does not have a submissive wife at all. So.
It kind of gets me uncomfortable when I hear the term referring to a husband as a spiritual leader or something. I don't know. I think, in my opinion, that's reserved for Christ only.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I think that Paul was trying his best to counsel people within the religious perceptions that he was currently in. And I do know that... The two concepts that Paul brings up there are mutually cancel each other out. That's just all there is to it. Because if the husband is supposed to love the wife, even as Christ loved the church, and the woman's supposed to submit to the husband in all things, then the wife's going to be able to say, I don't have to submit because you don't love me like Christ loved this church. And the husband's going to be able to say, I don't have to love you like Christ loves the church because you don't submit to me. So either way, whatever we come out of that whole concept that Paul presented there, number one, it is non-attainable for anyone, and and again, that is not where it is not any of the writings of the New Testament that we go to validate truth. The marriage in and of itself was instituted to give us a revelation of Christ. And as far as marriage in what it was to be, I don't believe exists anymore. Now society has a marriage, but I wade into this cautiously because it would take an awful lot of explaining. It's quite simple, but the fact of it is that marriage is strictly a social issue anymore. Marriage is not a gospel issue. Now, is that freaky or what?
Well, and Mike, as you've done, you did a series, or maybe it was just one particular teaching.
No, it was a whole series on marriage and divorce.
Marriage and divorce. And that was a liberating thing for me. And, you know, I'm very happy in my marriage. I've been married 22 years, and, I've married, I found the greatest woman in the world, so I'm, you know, I
yes,
wanted to be
did.
Married to her.
But one of the things that we know that when we're talking about marriage in the Bible, we're talking about marriage that the woman had no say-so in whatsoever.
Absolutely.
It was a marriage that was arranged by her parents. Sometimes even the man wouldn't have a say in it.
Absolutely.
But the woman in particular had no say in a marriage or a divorce.
Absolutely.
If you put these kind of things in the context of that kind of a marriage, it also shows us a beautiful picture of Christ's redemption, that we had no say-so in it. We're the bride of Christ, and we had no say-so whatsoever in our own redemption.
And we can't get a divorce.
Yeah, only the groom can divorce the bride.
Only the husband can divorce.
And we are the bride, so...
You're right, the wife.
No, it cannot be any other way.
The bride has no selection, and then as the wife, she has no divorce rights. Now, that sounds horrible until you put, like Greg said, until you put it in the reality of the gospel, and that is we were chosen by him, and we were included, and we can't even make a decision to get out of this, because there are no divorce laws for women to... Did you know that there's not one single law in the law of God that says these are the reasons a woman can get a divorce?
Mm-hmm. We have reasons a man can get a divorce.
Mm-hmm. So it's all strictly for the man. Now, why is that? Well, that was given that way not to show us the way we have to live, but to give us a revelation of Christ. But, you know, one of the things that Jesus said was that when the kingdom of God comes, there will be no such thing as giving or taking in marriage. So, again, let me say this very clearly. There is no such thing as spiritual marriage between two people anymore. That was a type and shadow that was established to give us a revelation of Christ. Marriage is a social issue altogether. It has nothing to do with God picking your mate. It has nothing to do with any of these things, because marriage, like the law, the marriage, like all prophecy, was fulfilled 2,000 years ago. Now, I am all for the way our society views and respects and supports a family. Now, that's being restructured. Thank God that people who are families that are couples of the same sex, because it's already that way. I mean, my goodness, families are made up of all kinds of things. Sometimes it's grandparents raising children. Sometimes it's children raising grandparents. Sometimes it's children from several marriages. But it's families. It's families that come together. And I'm all supportive of anything that helps a family to be and become and thrive as family. But I think that is much more likely to be accomplished if we take the spiritual aspect out of it. And by taking the spiritual aspect out of it, we apply the spiritual aspect to their equality in the eyes of God, which gives them a much higher possibility of the relationship actually being successful.
Mike, we've kind of come to the end here. I want to say one more thing before we stop. When I can remember being a teenager and worrying that God's perfect choice for my mate wouldn't be somebody that I found sexually attractive, because God couldn't possibly want me to marry a really hot girl.
Oh, I know.
That's
what was that one prophet, and he went out and picked a prostitute for a wife off the street?
Oh, yeah.
I can't even remember the which one it was. It was one of the minor prophets. Anyway, he went out and picked a prostitute off the streets because God told him to. And I remember, yes, because you had to know from God which one it had to do. It could not have to do
exactly
with what was appealing to you at all. It had to be what God, and it could be a prostitute off the street or somebody you absolutely were not attracted to.
Well, that brings us to the end of the,
to the end of
the broadcast tonight. Jennifer, we thank you for calling in.
Thank
Jennifer
you. Your
Braddock
call was amazing.
Oh, yeah. Thank
South
you.
Carolina.
You can tell I'm also nervous about doing this. It's my first time. But
oh, please don't let it be your last.
Yeah. Oh, you did great. I'm a fill-in amateur tonight, so I'm just glad somebody called.
Come on. You've done this a couple of times, Greg.
So we'd just like to thank everybody for listening in. We'd like to remind you that you can get a hold of Mike if you go to the website. You can go to gospelrevolution.com, and you can find a way to get a hold of Mike if you need to. If you want to go to my blog, it's appraisingstuff.blogspot.com. And we'd just like to thank everybody for listening in tonight. And we would just like to end the broadcast by saying shalom, everybody.